Amen, amen. Well, hello everyone. How are y'all today? Oh man. I said, how are y'all today? Woo! Amen. Just give a round of applause to our amazing worship team. It's been great. So today I have the honor of presenting our speaker. Dr. Steven Sanders has been an adjunct professor of New Testament and Greek at Criswell since 2020. He has started full-time since last semester. He is also an adjunct professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. He's earned his master's degree in pastoral leadership and his doctorate in New Testament studies from DTS. He grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, but moved to Atlanta to go to college at Georgia Tech. Steven and his wife, Danielle, have been married for 20 years, and their daughter, Kate, is a fifth grader this year. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Steven Sanders.
I have a friend, and for the purposes of this story, we're going to call her Lauren. So Lauren has been married twice, and each time she's been married to a graduate of Dallas Seminary. Her first marriage, she got married, she had gone to a small, or not really that small, small compared to Georgia Tech, not at all small compared to us, but a Baptist college that is in Ohio, and she had grown up and she had always wanted to be a pastor's wife, because she thought that, given her upbringing, that was a way for her as a woman to support the ministry and be a part of a ministry, is by being the part, the wife of a pastor. And so when she was at college, she met, and then right after college, she married another graduate of the same institution. And he was going to go into the ministry, and so they moved to Dallas, and he went to DTS and got his master's degree there. Well, from almost the beginning, they really, really struggled in marriage, which happens at times. And but as time went on, they just really were not, they never found their feet. It wasn't like an adjustment period. It had gone on years, and they weren't connecting, and it was getting worse and worse. And so she started to get counseling. They got marital counseling through the seminary. And so the counselor at one point, I want to be clear because it's kind of nuanced if you're not used to this, he advised them to have a temporary separation, not to get a divorce, but to begin to live in different places temporarily so that they could find a new ground to kind of work on their issues. And so when she tells the story, she was going over to his apartment one night, and he had graduated by this point, and he was working as a youth minister at a church in the area. And she had just, like, it was almost like God gave her this picture that, like, their marriage was like a jigsaw puzzle, and there was, like, this piece missing, and she couldn't figure out what that piece was. And so she gets there, and they're talking, and she says, I feel like we have talked about this for years and years and years now, but I feel like there's just something, like, in the middle between us that we're not talking about, and I don't know what it is. And he said to her, it's funny you should say that, because I do know what it is. And he said, I actually have an addiction to pornography, and it has led me more recently to acquire some personal, like, financial debt because I've been paying for so much pornography. And she said, well, okay, that's probably the piece, and we can work through this, but obviously we'll take steps, but I love you and I want to make this work. And he said, well, that's not all the part of the problem. Recently, I've started to go to prostitutes for sex. And she said, well, that's a lot heavier, but I still think there's hope and we can work through that. And he said, no, what I'm trying to tell you is I'm happier with the prostitutes. And so eventually they got divorced. The church ended up obviously dismissing him, but also at her church, the church obviously didn't know what to do with the former wife of the youth minister who was fired for this choice. And so she ended up not having any real connection with that church during that time, and ended up going on quite the journey herself. Eventually came back to know the Lord, but it was, you know, devastating for a while. I want to talk in this chapel about internet pornography addiction. I think it's a problem. I think it's a pervasive problem in a room this size. There are people in here who struggle with it or actively struggling with internet pornography addiction. There are people who have close family members or close friends, loved ones who struggle with internet pornography addiction. If somehow you don't fall into those two categories, then at some point you're gonna minister to somebody with internet pornography addiction. And so I think it's something that does need to be addressed. I feel like this is a decent venue for addressing it, at least on occasion. But, you know, as I started to think about addressing this issue, I was thinking back, I've been full-time here for now, this is my second year, and I don't remember a chapel myself, which I've come to over half of them, where we've really directly addressed that at all in 2 years. It might have happened, but I feel like even if I wasn't here, I'd hear about it, you know, in a class. Some student asked me something, and then I go on a rant. But I feel like there are reasons we don't talk about it, because it's really awkward. It's uncomfortable. It's hard to talk about. And honestly, I've been like thinking and mulling this over for, you know, I think Luis gave me the opportunities. Luis does a great job with chapel. But Luis gave me this opportunity, you know, a couple months ago, and I've kind of been thinking about it probably for about a month. And last week I was like, no, I am not going to do it. I'm going to go with a comfortable passage. I have many. I've worked up a number of sermons. We're going to do one of those. And I just felt like, yeah, but if it's not me, who is it going to be? Are we really going to get a guest speaker up here? And then their one chapel at Criswell, they're going to talk about internet porn. So I was like, well, you know, I guess in my mind's eye, if there is a person who would talk about this in Criswell Chapel, probably looks suspiciously like myself. But I was thinking through it, and the one time we even have, like, the one time I can remember the word has even come up was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. We had a speaker, and during the Q&A, one of our students asked the speaker about steps that the convention is doing to protect women. And as part of his answer, this is not a direct quote, but he more or less said, we have a society that's just rampant with pornography. What do you expect? And I was dissatisfied with that answer. Not because I disagree with the premise, but I disagree with two elements of kind of the subtext. Number one, we have a society that's rampant with all kinds of sin. That doesn't absolve us of our responsibility to follow the commands of Christ. Just because it is really easy to sin, it's not our calling as Christians to say, well, what can you do? And second of all, as far as the, well, what can you do? What do you expect? There are things you can do. And so if there are things you can do and it's a problem, we need to talk about that. And so that's what I want to talk about. We'll talk a little bit about a Bible passage, but only as a setup to talk about my experience in ministry with talking to people about this issue. I'm being honest with you. I don't honestly at this point in my life get super nervous about speaking opportunities very often. Like I used to, but I just, like, at this point, I guess, I don't know, maybe I don't care. I just don't. But I am a little bit with this, and I feel like I've thought more about less about the content of what I'm actually going to say. Like I've talked to dozens and dozens, maybe even 100 different guys who struggle with this problem over the last 20 years of ministry. Like I know the talking points. But my struggle was more with the feel of what a chapel, you know, what a chapel about this should feel like. And that's why I requested no podium. That's why for the first time for a chapel, I'm not wearing a suit and tie. I don't want you to look at this and feel like there is a guy preaching with like the biggest Bible he owns, like unloading on you in some way. I want this to feel like more of a conversation, albeit a one-sided conversation, but I want it to feel more like this is my understanding of like what the problems are, and can we just like address some of the problems to do with this. So as I was thinking about like what is my goal for talking about this in a chapel, I was reminded of something I read a long time ago. I was reading a book by Brené Brown, and she was writing a book. It's called Daring Greatly. But in it, Brené Brown, she's a researcher and a counselor, a social worker. But she started talking about the difference that she had uncovered in her research between shame and guilt. And so for me, as I was reading that, those two kind of, they're like really closely related. And so sometimes I confuse that in my mind, like what is the difference or if there is even a difference. But the way she defined it is that shame is a way of looking at a situation and internalizing it as saying something about yourself. Like it's a way of looking at behavior, but saying, this is who I am. Guilt, on the other hand, is looking at a behavior and seeing it as the behavior, not necessarily as you, but it is something you do. And her point here was, for instance, if you do something and you have shame, you would think, I'm a bad person. If you have guilt, you would think, I did a bad thing. Let's say you're in a test and you cheat on the test. If you have shame about it, you think, well, now I'm a cheater. If you have guilt about it, you think, well, I cheated on this test. And so what's really the difference? Well, the difference is, according to her research, she did not believe from her research findings that shame ever really leads to positive lasting change in the research she did. And again, this is not the point of the whole thing. I'm not going fully into it, but you can read the book if you're interested in it. But that shame doesn't lead to lasting change. Guilt, on the other hand, creates a cognitive dissonance because it allows you to think, I cheated on this test, but I'm not a person who values honesty. And so there's this cognitive dissonance between what I did and what I really believe, and it allows you to address the behavior without really worrying about who you are yourself. And that allows a pathway. People who have guilt as opposed to shame, they don't always necessarily change, but it gives you the opportunity to address a behavior without the overall implications. And this is important, I feel like, for talking about internet pornography addiction, because I want the tone to be talking about the behavior, and I'm worried that in a discussion like this, if you are struggling with it, at times you feel like this is a part of your identity at this point. And so really, I guess the tenor of what I want to come away with from this talk is one of courage and of hope. I want us to be courageous enough to confront the brutal facts, something that is not easy to talk about, but it's something that's in our environment and we need to address it. And so that takes some courage. And if you're struggling with this, it's courageous just to be here and listen to it on some level. But I also want to have hope, because what can you do? Well, I'm not sure what I can do. I'm not sure what you can do, but I know what Christ can do. Because I know who he is, and I don't know what he will do, but I know he is powerful enough to overcome even that. And so we always have hope. And so I would like to talk about the behavior and talk about how to take steps forward. Now, the text I want to talk about today, and I'm only talking about one verse because I didn't want to bring the biggest Bible I own, so like I'm on a one-verse limit here. But it's 1 Corinthians 6:18, and some of you know this verse. The verse says, "Flee sexual immorality. Every sin a person commits is outside the body. But the one who sins sexually sins against his or her body." And I want to make two observations about that verse. The first observation is the word choice he uses when he says flee sexual immorality. The Greek word there is porneia. And porneia is a word that is very broad in Koine Greek. He does not, and I believe intentionally, he does not use the word adultery. Like when Paul says this, notice he's not quoting the Ten Commandments. He doesn't say flee adultery. And the reason for this, I believe, is because in the Greco-Roman world of that time, they saw a difference between these two words. This is not a difference in like for Jewish people of the time, but for general Gentile Greco-Roman. Adultery, and there's a double standard. I'm sure you're shocked by this. There are different rules for men and women. But for men, what adultery meant was you're not allowed to sleep with another man's wife. And even in general Greco-Roman society, that's off limits. Don't sleep with another man's wife. But what is outside the bounds of that definition of adultery is sleeping with prostitutes, sleeping with slaves, Basically, anybody who is not a woman married to a man is within bounds of morality. And so he picks a larger concept, porneia, because it fits all of these kind of edge cases where we're like, is this sin or is this not sin, that kind of thing. And I think this is important to point out in the discussion, because I've had a conversation before with a guy, and he said, well, what Paul's talking about in this passage, it's not internet pornography. I mean, and I was like, yeah, he's not. In fact, Paul doesn't say really anything about, you know, the internet. And he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't address videos or really even photographs. He's surprisingly silent on that topic. And I did recognize the irony of this person trying to explain to me how porn is not a part of porneia. But my issue wasn't even in the semantics of it. It's that Paul is intentionally finding a broad category. And so whether the actual way we sin sexually was available to Paul or not, he's intentionally picking a term that would cover all bases at this point. And so we are called to flee all forms of sexual immorality. And the other thing I want to point out, which is probably even more obvious in the translation, is he contrasts every sin and then sexual immorality. There's a sense in which sexual immorality is a unique sin. It has unique consequences. And the implications of this, what I'm not saying, is that it's, you know, uniquely bad or it should be uniquely taboo. It's just that every other sin, there is a spiritual aspect. But on some level, with sexual immorality, there is both a spiritual and a physical aspect. And scholars disagree, you know, differ, because scholars differ, you know. But scholars differ on what exactly this means, and I don't know what it means. But it's just my observation that internet pornography involves a spiritual component, but it also involves a physical component. And in my experience, and this was like game-changing for me in ministry, like talking to people about this. In my experience, people naturally, as Christians, tend to take a spiritual solution to sin, and a lot of times that might work. But with internet pornography, if you only address the spiritual dimension and you don't address the physical dimension, then the physical dimension will continue to exist, and it leads to this cycle of frustration where you wonder, why is it that I've prayed time and time again to God and I feel some relief, but then I go and I do this again and I don't really want to do it, but I've prayed, Lord, and Lord, where are you? And part of that is these people, well-intentioned, have addressed a spiritual dynamic of the sin, but they haven't addressed the physical dynamic. And so I want to talk a little bit about the physical dynamic. Now, what I'm about to say, I'm not an expert in, and, you know, go to YouTube. You can find a better understanding of this. But just for the foundation, what we're going to talk about, when God created our brains, he created them in such a way that we have what neurologists call a reward circuit. And what a reward circuit means is there are certain mechanisms by which our brain naturally reinforces behavior that is important to our survival, either as an individual or as a community. And so this would be like, if you get food, the brain gives you some amount of pleasure. If you find water, the brain gives you some amount of pleasure. If you are an active part of a community for protection and for whatever, you know, your parents, the brain gives you some amount of pleasure. But also, if you have sex, the brain gives you some amount of pleasure. And what ends up happening is the brain will start to respond to that pleasure by craving the behaviors that lead to that pleasure. And usually that is a good thing because it guides us towards doing the kinds of things that we need for maintenance and survival for ourselves. And that's a great thing. The problem occurs when you start to have a behavior that will trigger that and you have an unlimited supply of that behavior. And so if we lived back in caveman times and you found some food and you ate some food, that's great, and the brain rewards you for that. It may go, well, you may go a little while before you eat again. If you live in 2023 and you have an unlimited supply of food, if you keep eating, it'll keep triggering, and then all of a sudden you will, you know, eventually become obese. Now, with sex, if you have sex occasionally, this will reinforce, you know, the survival of the species on some level. But if you have an unlimited supply of sexual material that you can look at that is completely novel, and you could go for the entirety of your life and never see the same thing twice, and it's easily accessible and it's free, What ends up happening is it will trigger that mechanism over and over again. And these neural components, they communicate, you may remember this with like science, like there's neurons in your brain and they don't touch, there's a synapse, there's a gap between them. And the way they connect is they release what's called a neurotransmitter, and the transmitter is like a chemical and it jumps the gap and it communicates, and this is how your brain, you know, cells communicate with one another. Well, what ends up happening in the reward circuit is you do one of these important behaviors, it releases a neurotransmitter called dopamine, and then the other brain receives it and you have some pleasure and some motivation to do it again at some point. Well, if you turn the pleasure center on indefinitely, it will keep kicking out dopamine. And ultimately, two things will happen. The first thing that will happen is your brain will learn that the easiest way to dopamine is this behavior. And it will start to prioritize that behavior that is an easy hit of dopamine above any other behavior, and so more and more you're attracted to that behavior. The second thing that will happen is eventually your brain will be flooded with dopamine, and there's so much dopamine that your receptors can't take all of it in and they become desensitized. And so what you need is an even greater hit of dopamine to get the same response of pleasure, and so you move to something more and more shocking or more and more novel or more and more, whatever word I want, we'll go with shocking. So I had a student once, and this, with all due respect to everybody in here, this student is probably the brightest student I ever had. She was a Ivy League graduate in engineering. She had been a Marine and served with distinction. After being a Marine, she went to a prestigious college in Washington, D.C., and she had gotten her law degree. And she had ended up working with the Department of Justice. Through various means, she ended up being a DTS student in one of my classes. And specifically, though, what she did with the Department of Justice is that she prosecuted child pornographers. And so there was a dinner where Danielle and I had gone with her out to Conoroso down on Gaston. And we were kind of talking about her experience. And she said one of the things she learned was if somebody ends up with an addiction to pornography, what will happen over time is, in her experience, one of two things will happen. They will start to look at images that involve either more and more violence, because that becomes more shocking and it will trigger a higher release once they become numb to their normal release, or they will look at something that portrays people who are younger and younger, and that will trigger a release as well. And so an addiction, it never is like on pause. It's never like a feature of your life. It's always going to try to grow and grow because it wants more and more dopamine to get the same kind of release. Now, the third thing I want you to know is that is the idea of neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity means that your brain physically can change. And this is good news and bad news. It's bad news because if you have internet pornography addiction, over time, your brain will actually physically start to change. And I think this is part of the physical problem that happens with internet pornography addiction. But the physical change that occurs will occur more and more as dopamine and other chemicals are released into your brain over time. That's the bad news. The good news is the change can go both ways. And I've known people who have stopped looking at internet pornography and they have had indefinite, extended amounts of time where they didn't look, like for years, didn't look at pornography after having an addiction. And the brain can also repair itself. Neuroplasticity goes both ways. And so it's possible for your brain to repair itself if you give it enough time that it's not flooding with dopamine. Okay, so in light of all of this physical information I just gave you, when I talk to people about internet pornography addiction, again, I've been doing this for 20 years. I have talked to dozens and dozens of guys who struggle with this. I was thinking last night, it may be over 100, specifically talking about their issues with internet pornography. I emphasize a number of things, but in the interest of time, we'll talk about three things. And it's all based on what I just said. Number one, I ask them how long they have gone without looking at pornography. And a lot of times they actually don't know. They just like, they know what happens. They know what happens regularly. They feel bad about it. So they're talking to me. And ultimately though, they're not really sure. So Danielle and I were out to dinner. This time we were at North Park Mall at the Breadwinner. So I'm just gonna call out restaurants now. But we were out to dinner with a student. This was a DTS student. I'm gonna call him Andrew. And the dinner ended, and if you've been to North Park Mall ever with a child, you might know that they have like a fountain that has ducks and turtles in them. It's kind of like weird if you don't know about this, but they do. And so Kate at the time was little and was fascinated by this. So Danielle took Kate to go look at the turtles, and the moment they had left, Andrew says, "Hey, Stephen, I sometimes look at internet pornography, and I would like to talk about that." And I was like, I mean, interesting venue, but okay. And what I asked him was, how long have you gone? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, is it an addiction? He's like, no, it's not an addiction. I just do this sometimes. I said, tell you what, go 30 days and just mark down on a calendar whenever you look at something you really would rather have not looked at. He came back a month later. The longest he had gone was like 3 days. I said, well, you got good news and bad news. It's the same news. You got an addiction. Like what you're wanting to do, you're regularly doing despite not wanting to do it. I said, but the good news is we know how to treat addiction. Like ultimately you're going to, in addition to praying, you're going to have to go for an extended amount of time without looking at pornography. And right now you clearly can't go more than 3 days, but maybe you can go for 5 days, or maybe you can go for 4 days. Let's see how long you can go. And then look at that. I said, if you wanted to build up your body physically, you'd go lift weights. And over time, you would build it up more and more. I said, you do that all the time. Why don't we treat the same thing here? Figure out what your record is and go for your record again. And try to keep going up and matching or exceeding your record over time. And over time, he would try for that. And I think that that's the physical mechanism to try to reverse the dopamine release here. You've got to be able to build up so that you can stop progressively over time the amount of dopamine that's flooding into your brain. The second thing I mention is, you need to be able to talk to somebody safe. And the word safe there is really important. Everybody's not great for this conversation. I was once in a community group. We're going to call this couple Jack and Jill. Jack had a internet pornography addiction, and he decided that he was going to use Covenant Eyes. You might have heard about this before. It's like an accountability software where it'll monitor whatever you do on the internet and then send it to your accountability partner, and then they'll chew out whenever, you know, you look at something you shouldn't. But he decided he was going to do it. He was going to use Covenant Eyes with his wife. That's not a safe move, I'm just telling you. Now, it actually went really well in her opinion. He had gone months and months without looking at any pornography, and it like saved their marriage. The problem is that they ended up having in the community group a time for the women to get together, and so there was a session where the women got together at Jill's house. And so Danielle was over there, and Jill's talking about like how Covenant Eyes had solved all their problems. And so she said, I'll show you how it works. I'll just log into my account so you can see what I have looked at, because I haven't looked at any porn. And so she logs in, and it like pulls it up, and it's one porn site after another porn site after another porn site. And she freaks out. She's like, I did not look at this. And Danielle, who's a computer programmer and savvy, she's like, I don't think you did. She said, is it possible that, I'm remembering my names now, is it possible that Jack has figured out your password? See, that's not a safe person for him. And because of that, he started to hide the behavior, and things grow in the dark. You need somebody who is safe. If you're a minister, one of the reasons I'm convinced that Lauren's husband didn't talk to anybody was partly because he was a youth minister and he felt like he would get fired. But the problem is he got fired anyway. And it affected his brain, so he made a different choice. You have to find someone you can talk to. And I can't tell you who that is for you, but I can tell you that I myself have talked to hundreds of guys. If you are a guy, this is specific. Pornography, internet pornography is not just a male issue. That is like a false narrative. Many women do look at internet pornography. I know of some women, they haven't talked about their issues specifically, but I know that they struggle with internet pornography. I'm not a safe person if you're a woman to come talk to. But if you're a man, my door's always open. I'm easy to find. If you're a woman, Dr. Moore does have some experience talking about this, and she is a safe person, in my opinion, to go and talk to. If you need to talk, find somebody and talk to them, because things grow in the dark, and you start to become okay with certain behaviors over time because you've become desensitized. The third thing that I talk to guys about is guys have this behavior when they're trying to really confront the physical aspects of everything. The way I think about this is they decide they're going to destroy all the on-ramps. So if we all got in a bus and we decided that we were going to drive south on 45 and we just never exited, at some point we'd get to Houston. That's just what's going to happen. If internet pornography happens and you get on 45 and you keep going, at some point you're going to get to pornography, if you see what I'm saying. And guys will look at this and they'll decide, I'm going to figure out all the on-ramps I've taken for the highway to pornography, and I'm going to find some way to kill all of those off. I'll make sure, like I've had guys go from smartphone to flip phone. I've had them use all manners of internet filters. I've had them try to give up the internet altogether, any number of things. And, you know, if you were an alcoholic, not having alcohol in your house is probably a really good idea. There's nothing wrong with destroying an on-ramp. My issue with it is, at some point you're going to find yourself on 45. I mean, it's the world we live in. But there's ways to avoid going to Houston than just never getting on 45. You could also exit before you get to Houston. And so I think in addition to thinking through the on-ramps, if you have a struggle, think through possible off-ramps. What are things that you could have done before you started that gravitation towards looking at pornography that you could have done to maybe stop the circuit and get off the highway before you got there? Especially as you build up your length of time, the whole process slows down to some extent. So those are the three things I usually start with in conversations. How long? Who are you talking to? Are you talking to somebody safe? And what are your own ramps and what are your off ramps ultimately? And if you're on 45, don't hit the gas. Slow down, pull off, come back. Now, I said at the start, and this will be closed, that I want this to be a talk of courage and hope. And I want to kind of illustrate the way I think about this now. So I've asked a volunteer, and this is Dr. Keezer. So if you don't know Dr. Keezer, let's give him a round of applause. This is what he's about to do is very courageous. Okay, Dr. Keezer, I'm going to get you to stand to my right. So, to me, the way that I think of someone who's really struggling with internet pornography addiction, I'm going to want you to hold your arms out, is that it's almost like they're always carrying something around with them. Like, it's always there. Now, you want that towel. You good? Okay, so underneath a towel, can you tell what this is? This is cow manure, okay? A cow has pooped, it's right here, Dr. Keezer's holding it. What ends up happening is that you start to carry around, we'll call it stuff, with you, and it's a part of you on some level. It's not like it is you, but it is a behavior that is constant with you, and all of a sudden your brain has become affected. And over time, you get used to this. And it becomes not a big deal, but every time you relate to somebody, every time you go to your job, every time you go to the meal, you might not actively be looking at porn, but your brain has morphed into such that you're always carrying something with you. Dr. Keezer cannot live his best life. Whatever his goals in his life are, he cannot meet those goals if he insists on carrying cow manure around with him for the duration of his life. And the other struggle is, at some point, if you hold something long enough, you kind of build it up and your body adjusts and you get really used to holding cow manure, and you can hold even more, you know? And at some point, it just builds up. You still good? It just builds up. And it builds up and it becomes a part of your life. And at some point, you do confuse, is this me or is this a behavior I don't really agree with, but I'm just so used to it. Now, what also ends up happening is, I'm going to take one down, is that at some point, can you put that on the ground? At some point, you may go a stretch of time where you actually aren't looking at pornography. And I've had, you know, guys do this. But then eventually, maybe it's the longest stretch they've ever had. Maybe he couldn't go 3 days without holding cow manure. But now, let's say he goes 10 days without holding cow manure. But in the end, He's holding cow manure. Is that a win or is that a loss for him? See, because it's going to feel like a loss to him, because here I've done the thing that I have said I will never do again. I stuck my stick in the fire. I begged with God. But here I am again. But from my perspective, that is a win, because he is built up on the physical while maintaining the spiritual. And the question is, what is he going to do now? Is he going to put it down again? Go ahead and put it down again. Let's give it up for Dr. Kieser. But here's the thing. Let's say that Dr. Kieser puts the manure down. Does Dr. Kieser necessarily live his best life just because he's not carrying cow manure around with him? Not necessarily. What we know is he cannot have the relationships with people or the relationship with God if he insists on carrying manure around. That is not a possibility. But it also doesn't mean just because he's not that he will have the life he wants, ideally. And I think sometimes the problem with addiction too is we make the process in sin avoidance the point of life. And so I want to close with this in terms of hope. Sin avoidance is not the point of life. Sin avoidance is a means to an end. And it doesn't really even matter what your sin is. We're talking about a specific sin here, but sometimes we can make spirituality avoiding and do not. And God, he gives us some do nots. And why does he give us the do nots? So we can have the life he wants and designed us to have. He needs us to put the poop down. But just because we put the poop down does not mean we have the relationship with God we want. And so always the goal, in my opinion, for a best life has to be, what is the relationship you actually want with the Lord? And ultimately, do you understand that God has adopted you as his child? That is who you are. And maybe your actions at different points in time are inconsistent with that, but God can handle that. There are many people... Is this on? No. There are many people who have overcome addictions. I know numerous people who have overcome addictions. That is a possibility. But just because they overcame the addiction does not mean they have the life with God they want. And so I want to end with just a moment of reminder for all of us that we're not here to avoid sin. We avoid sin because we are here to have the best possible relationships with one another and with God that we can have. And if you're carrying poop around, that is a community issue. Figure out how long you can go. Talk to somebody safe. Figure out how to avoid getting on 45, but also figure out how to get off of 45. Because ultimately, if you can't figure out those things, you can't have the life of God that you really want. And that is a loss, not for me and not for us, although it is. It's primarily a lost opportunity for you, because God wants to have that relationship with you, and he's trying to encourage you to just put the stuff down. Okay, I've asked Dr. Hunter to do the Q&A, and so can you give applause to Dr. Hunter?
All right. Yes. Also, a round of applause for Dr. Sanders addressing such a necessary and sensitive topic. So first of all, I'd just like to say I'm just impressed with who you are.
Thank you.
Because you're deeply academic. Mm-hmm. You're brilliant, mm-hmm. I think. But also, you have a pastor's heart. Mm-hmm. And I really like how you addressed it. Really mm-hmm. was reflected in your message. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. That's high praise coming from you, because you're the same way, in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh. Mm-hmm. We need to hang out more often.
We should.
Yeah.
We should have more faculty meetings.
Yeah. Let's just talk now. Mm-hmm. No. Okay. Anyway. But so a couple of things I want to emphasize is, really, I think it's mm-hmm. so very important in addressing any addiction that mm-hmm. it's two sides of the coin, mm-hmm. both the spiritual dimension and the physical mm-hmm. dimension. Very, very mm-hmm. important.
Yeah.
Also, love the manure mm-hmm. illustration.
Yeah, I thought some people good. Like kind of lowest common denominator. Yeah. You feel like a person who can appreciate that.
Yeah, right? And anybody who would say poop in mm-hmm. chapel, I really mm-hmm. appreciate that.
Yep.
But anyway, my question is, you struggled with it mm-hmm. in thinking about mm-hmm. having a sermon on mm-hmm. this topic.
Yeah.
What motivated you to finally push through and say, I'm going to do it?
I think it just needs to be talked about on occasion, not all the time. I also think we can over-talk about things. You know, I think my own personal opinion is in churches today, we talk about sex too much anyway. It like becomes a thing, you know. But it needs to be, this needs to be addressed every once in a while because things grow in the dark. And I guess in my mind, there's certain things that I think this particular audience needs to hear, and this is one of those things, and it hadn't been addressed, you know, as long as I can remember.
Yeah, excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to open it up for anybody that might have a question. So I saw Robert.
Mm-hmm. Also, if you want to ask for a friend, that's always allowed too.
Yeah, right.
You hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. You said that even if you put the manure down, that you still may not be on the path that you want to be. Mm-hmm. So even when you put it down, how do you get back on that path?
Yeah, I think that our orientation, this is kind of the point, or at least the way I think about it. I want to put the poop down in my own life, whatever that might be. But ultimately, there are times where I can be satisfied that I haven't done this or I haven't done that for so long. But the reality is I'm also not engaging with God. And so my orientation always has to be, am I going to God more and more? Am I naturally, it's not even like a checklist, like quiet time or something like that. It's more like, I can feel in myself, am I taking my issues to Him rather than kind of living life on my own power? Because oftentimes, if we live a life, in my opinion, that is sin avoidance, we can turn, because non-Christians sometimes overcome addictions. You can theoretically overcome an addiction without the Lord at all, or at least directly. I mean, you know what I mean. You don't have to have a relationship with Him to overcome an addiction. We can make sin avoidance into Christian self-help. And what I want in my own life is for, I want to get to heaven. It's like nothing happened. Like I already know the Lord. It's just like, hey, I'm here now, you know? I don't want to wait to heaven to know who the Lord is. And so it's kind of like my marriage. I want my orientation, whether times are going good or bad with Danielle, is I am towards us. But also my orientation with the Lord, I always want, and now He's always towards us. I waver, but I want generally for me to be towards us. And just because I'm avoiding sin does not necessarily mean I'm towards us, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's a great word. So that really our greatest desire is, and greatest goal is not freedom from addiction, but freedom in Christ. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Anybody else have a question? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And while you're saying that, while she's moving, I'll also say, freedom from addiction is a necessary component ultimately to experience the fullness of freedom of Christ. But freedom of Christ is more broad than freedom of addiction. Sometimes we narrow that.
So my question here is, I feel like often in issues of sin like this, especially, you know, severe sin, mm-hmm. Such as pornography addiction, we can sometimes have a tendency to be like, oh, that's a problem for unbelievers. That's people outside the church. I'd heard a statistic, something like 90% of men, and I don't remember if it was 40 or 60% of women, both inside and outside the church, are struggling with this issue. So Dr. Hunter or Dr. Sanders, I don't know if you're familiar with the statistics, and I know statistics are always a little unreliable, but yeah, could you just speak briefly to the pervasiveness of it, and that it's not an issue that we can afford to ignore?
Yeah, is in my ministerial, I don't know the statistics, you may be better on that point, but in my ministry experience, it's pervasive, and what I wanted to emphasize, and I may not have even talked about it enough, is that it's not a male problem either. Like, sometimes it's presented by that in the church, and my illustrations were male, but that because that's who I'm talking to. But it is male and female, and I think in some ways it takes even more courage for a woman because it's somehow more taboo. And so if you're a woman and you struggle with this, you're not alone in struggling with it at all. There's nothing more wrong with you than if you were a man struggling with it. And the same things apply. How long can you go? Can you talk to somebody safe like Dr. Moore or someone else? And think about the on-ramps and the off-ramps. But it is a pervasive issue in terms of, so one of the things I think I haven't mentioned that's really kind of interesting to me is that I was not prepared for how pervasive it necessarily was when I first got out of seminary. And I think part of that is I grew up, maybe you did too, in the 1900s. And so, actually, this is serious. It's not a joke. Like, the first time you had internet, was it AOL or like CompuServe or something?
Dr. Brown is the expert on that, so she's
okay.
Second.
Well, okay, yes. The first time I had internet, or I was like on the internet, it was America Online. And what you would do is it would dial into your phone and it would kind of go, and then it would tell you if you had mail or not. But if you downloaded an image, I'm not saying pornography, I'm saying an image, it would like come in chunks. It's like, you wait a few seconds, boom. You wait a few seconds, this is one picture, boom. You wait a few seconds, boom. And everything before the internet, there was pornography and there was probably addiction. But the thing that has changed with high-speed internet is your access to it. And so the game has really changed phenomenally for anyone. Like, my age probably is like the cutoff one way or another in the way I think about it. The first time I had anything that was close to high speed was my freshman year in college, which was, dating myself here, but 1999. And I went to Georgia Tech, and they had, for the time, very, very, very fast internet. And the shocking thing was, by the time I graduated, my parents probably in their house had the same speed of internet that we had at Tech my freshman year. And so anyone younger than me, they had access to unfiltered internet at an incredibly young age when their brain is more neuroplastic. And so it does more changes quickly. Now, the good news is it'll also change back more quickly depending on, you know, how quickly, you know, and how far you dig the ruts than someone older. But if you were, the first time you looked at pornography online was younger than the age of 25, your brain was still developing. And so that really changes the equation too, from even, because I would know people my age who have or had internet pornography addiction, but nobody was streaming video my freshman year in college. You know, nowadays you can do nothing but if you wanted to. And so I think the game has really changed, and that has skyrocketed up. And so we kind of live in a new world with that. I think only now even the wider world understands there are some behavioral and addictive elements to this.
Yeah, that's excellent. We have time for one more question. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
So recently I have one wife that reached out to me that her husband actually have the problem, watch the pornography. It came back and forth a little bit. I think overall it's getting better, but I think it really hurts the relationship.
It does.
Yeah. Especially, when you are in the marriage and you have kids, things like that. And for my friend, they are getting ready to adopt. Mm-hmm. Children. So, okay, my question is, do you have any books you're going to recommend it for, people, either the wife or the husband, to read on this topic?
He's actually going to be better on this, but I am going to mention one resource. And this is when I first started about the physical dynamic. It was actually it was probably like 15 years ago, but I actually looked it up last night because I was interested. I hadn't looked at it in years. But about 15 years ago, I was talking to a guy, and he mentioned this website. And I want to emphasize, this is not a Christian website at all. It is a researcher. But the website is Your Brain on Porn, and Now I'm Worried About like the End of It. But the guy who does the website, his name is Gary Wilson. I saw it last night. And the website is yourbrainonporn.com. I'm going with .com, but I would Google Gary Wilson and Your Brain on Porn is what I would do. But what he does is he talks about the biological issues and some of the, but more from a secular perspective, and that helped me out understanding like the physical dynamic in addition to the spiritual dynamic. So there are books, but Dr. Hunter, I know you're going to have better options on that than I am.
Yeah, I do think Gary Wilson's a great resource. And plenty of stories of men breaking free, and that's very, very helpful. I like the book by Joe Dallas. It's called The Game Plan. It's a strategy for maintaining, experiencing and maintaining purity, sexual purity. Because a lot of times, the church, don't look at porn. Oh, you looked at porn, we're gonna slap your hand, or you're going to go blind. But what we miss is a huge piece, and that's a strategy. And so the book is written for, men, The Game Plan, but it gives a 30-day strategy for attaining and maintaining sexual purity. And for me personally, I like the strategy. Work it out, A, B, C. And so then you have a strategy, you have a game plan, you have some steps in place in order to experience freedom from addiction, specifically porn addiction, but also freedom in Christ. And he shares his own personal story, and that first time I read it, it was total shock. So he's completely and totally transparent in sharing his own story, and the message to me was, wow, if he can experience freedom in this area, anyone can. It's an excellent book. Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing we want to both emphasize too, in addition to that, is just our complete empathy with that situation. Yes. We know that's difficult. It's hard as a friend to even know what to say. And it's really hard in that situation. And that's one of the reasons I think it is important to bring it to life. So I'm really sorry for your friend in that situation. And I'm really glad she has you to talk to.
Yeah, and remember, with any addiction, especially addiction, any type of sexual addiction too, you're not going to break free from your own. Mm-hmm. So a good first practical step is to talk to somebody safe, mm-hmm. and share your story and allow the Lord to work from that point forward. Okay? Well, once again, let's give Dr. Sanders a round of applause. Thank you so very much. I'm going to say thank you for being here at Excellent Chapel and enjoy the rest of your day.